somewhere along the line, somehow, today we finish the Parsha of Givonim, Perek Tet. We move on next week to Perek Yud. Maybe even today. Yeah, I'm going to blin that. The one remaining issue in the story of the Givonim that we have been diligently stewing over for the last couple of sessions is the... Well, there's actually two. I don't know if we're going to get to both. One is the reason why... The reason given in the Navi is to why they maintain their commitment to the Givonim, even though they know that it was on false pretense. And there's an element here of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem we're going to look at in the context of the Givonim and maybe even in a broader context. And the other piece, which is sort of the postscript to the story, is of the course of history, biblical history, what happens to the Givonim? What do we know about them? Where do they end up going? Can we trace the history of the Givonim beyond just the story of Yehoshua Perek Tet? And there are some interesting issues there, including some very significant tragedies. So we're going to take a look at that a little bit, time permitting. So let's take a let's just go back to Perek Tet for a moment, and let's start from Perek from Pasuk Tet Zayin. If you want, there's a Tanakh over here. You can. You've got one? Oh, okay, good.
Thank you.
Pasuk Tet Zayin. Vayihi miktzei shloshit yamim, acharei asher kartu lehem brit. So 3 days after Bnei Yisrael made this brit with the Givonim, again under false pretense, they were misled, assuming to be told that they were from a faraway land, and not from the Shiva Amim, and then they discover Vayishmu ki krovim hem elav ubekibo hem yoshvim. They learned that they are close and that they dwell amongst them. They live right here north of Yerushalayim in the area of Givon, and that they are certainly from the Amiknan, the descendants of the Chivi, and everything that they had been told was in fact a lie. Vayisu b'nei Yisrael v'yavo el areihem b'yom ha'shlishi. In 3 days the army was upon them. The names of the cities, some of which we are familiar with today, specifically Kiryat Yarim is the most well-known among of them. Kiryat Yarim is the modern city of Telstone. Excuse me?
As you draw, you see the
Yeah,
sign.
You see Kiryat Yarim. Kiryat Yarim, Telstone. So they get there. And they discovered that clearly the entire pretense was a lie. So what do they do? Now the simplest, most logical course of action was to assume that the brit is null and void and then deal with the Givonim the way they would have dealt with any nations of Canaan who would have tried such a ruse on them, which would be to teach them a lesson with a capital L by the sword. In this case, Velohi kum b'nei Yisrael did not smite them for the reason given kinishba'u lehem nisiyei ha'eda b'ashem elokei Yisrael, because the oath that the nisiyei ha'eda had taken, a public oath with the name of God, b'ashem elokei Yisrael. At that point, Vayelonu kol Aidal Nesiim, the people got very angry at the Nesiim because they realized that the hands were tied, but not necessarily by their own choice. The hands were tied by that which the Nesiim had done. V'yamu kol Nesiim al kol Aida, anachlo nishbanu lehem b'Hashem Elokei Yisrael. The Nesiim said to Bnei Yisrael, you can't do anything about this. We took an oath. V'yata lo nuchal lingoa behem. We can't touch them. Zot nase lehem. Let's let them live, so that God will not be angry at us for the oath that we took, meaning for the violation of the oath, if we were to destroy them. So then they came up with the suggestion that we're going to let them work for Bnei Yisrael, turn them into woodcutters and water carriers, etc. And we, last week we, was it last week or 2 weeks ago?
Yeah,
2 weeks ago. Last year, last week was poor. In our last shiur, we talked about the various components of leadership that are playing roles in this parak. The role of the Nesiim, the role of the Eidah, the role of the Ishei Yisrael, the role of Yehoshua. There are various components, and we talked a little bit about this decree of Chotvei Etzim Yeshua V'mayim. Specifically, what I wanted to do today, what I wanted to address today, was this issue of the Shvua. What is this oath? What is its significance? Why does it bind their hands? Clearly an oath on false pretense. The whole issue is a lie. Why should it be binding on them at all? How can a brit based on an absolute falsehood, from any legal vantage point, they should be able to take the brit, the piece of paper upon which this brit is written, rip it up, l'hayavale nivra, and move on. And yet they don't. They, forever, for generations, they will live with the Givonim as a part of Bnei Yisrael, all the way up to the time of Chazal. Chazal talk about the Givonim, they have a different name for them. They call them the Netinim. We'll talk about why that's so in a moment, but the Givonim as a group, as an entity, exist all the way up to the time of Chazal. So clearly they're around for a very long time. Because
of
that's an interesting question. Their status in halacha is open to discussion. Whole issue of the conversion status, and did they convert, didn't they convert, what's the status? I'm going to leave that issue for now. It's a complicated sugya in the Gemara. But the question that has to be asked is, what is this oath and why is it so binding on them? So I prepared a couple of sources on this topic. We'll delve a little bit into the halachic context. And we end up with an interesting discussion, both in the Gemara as well as in the Rishonim, as to what is going on. So let's start with the Gemara in Gittin. The Gemara in Gittin raises exactly this question. Source number one: Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Kol Neder Shiyadu Barabim Lo Yachzir, VeShelo Yadu Barabim Yachzir. There is a notion of Hatarat Nedarim. Annulling an oath. Another question that we could have asked, and maybe we should ask, is that they made an oath, and the oath is on false pretense. We have a simple solution for an oath on false pretense. There's a mechanism built into the concept of an oath that the Torah establishes for annulling an oath. Hatarat nedarim, or hafarat nedarim. There's a difference between hatarat nedarim and hafarat nedarim. Lahatir brit, lahatir neder means to acknowledge that circumstances had changed, and therefore you were unable to fulfill the brit, so fulfill the neder, and you ask the Beit Din to absolve you of the neder on the basis of the fact that you no longer see, or that you no longer feel able or capable of living up to the expectation. You thought you could at the time, but either because you realize that you were unable to, or because the circumstances are changed, you can go to the Beit Din and ask them to matir the brit, or to latir means latir means to dismiss or to permit. Comes from the word heter or mutar. It's the same word. Actually, the root of the word means to untie. Latir kesher is to untie a knot. So you untie the brit. Lahafer brit, or lahafer neder, is to come to the Beit Din and say the entire pretense upon which this neder was based is not true. We discover new information that indicates that the foundation of this neder was false, and therefore the oath is made null and void in the sense that it never happened. It's completely removed. So it's not like you're taking a knot and untying it. You realize that the knot was never tied.
Like an annulment.
And one works retroactively and one doesn't. It's a whole discussion in the halach of the implication of lahatir brit versus lahafer brit. In our case, what they could have easily—they could have gone so far as lahafer et neder. They could have gone so far as to say the neder was based on false pretense and therefore is not binding at all. They don't even have to go through the mechanism of hatarat neder. They had a much broader pretense for annulling this oath, which is to establish.
Do you use that annulment today? That kind of.
Of hafarat neder,
but
you can. It's the circumstances are usually not that common. The biblical context of hafarat neder was in the context of an oath that a wife takes that a husband is allowed to annul on the day that he hears the oath. That's the parsha at the beginning of Parshat Mas'ei, because a wife can take a neder that binds her husband, and because the context of marriage was such that the husband was. Unless stipulated differently in the ksuba, essentially responsible financially for the provision for the family, wife can't take a neder that would bind her husband's financial ability to provide for her or to provide for the family. And therefore the Torah allows for a mechanism whereby if she takes an oath that he's uncomfortable with or can't live with, he has the right within a very short window to say no, that can't be, and to essentially annul the oath. That's the beginning of Parshat Matot. That's the whole notion of hafarat neder. That's the source for it. In normal circumstances, first of all, today it doesn't apply for the most part because the structure of marriage and the structures of ksubas are different. But otherwise, in general, there aren't that many circumstances to which it would apply. Most people who take a neder, well, we don't take nedarim today. We don't do nedarim, and certainly not with Shem Hashem. But in most circumstances today, if you go for hatarat nedarim, you go to a beit din. It's usually because you took an oath or you took a commitment. It's usually the case of a commitment that you no longer feel you can live up to. But the notion of a false pretense to retroactively remove the neder altogether, it's very rare. Circumstances would really be remarkable. There aren't that many nedarim b'chlal that operate in today's world. We've essentially gone away from the whole application of nedarim.
But you still do it before you
get. We do atar neder, but
it's not the same.
It is and it isn't. It's more because of the possibility that maybe we may have inadvertently somewhere along the line during the year would have said I'll do something or I won't do something.
Right.
Yes, technically, maybe not the kind of nedarim we're talking about here. The kind of nedarim we're talking about here was a declaration that was made with a specific formula, b'shem Hashem, and you invoked God's name in the neder. It was a very different mechanism. It's a very different mechanism. What the Gemara here is saying is that if it's a neder sheyadu bo rabim, this is a neder that has a specific phrase, neder al da'at rabim.
Is marriage a neder?
No. Marriage works under a completely different set of circumstances of the kinyan and the marriage contract is not a neder. Marriage contract operates under the formula of kinyan and contract. None of this applies in contract law. This is all a whole different branch of halach. Neder al da'at rabim means you took the oath with the knowledge of the tzibur, of the community, of the public, of the rabim. A neder taken with the knowledge of the public, or neder taken in public, operates under different parameters to a neder taken privately. And here the Gemara wants to assert the position that kol neder sheyadu barabim lo yachzir, that if you have a neder that's made publicly, it can never be annulled. And there are several instances in Tanakh where we have such circumstances of public nedarim for which there could or should have been a mechanism for annulment, and there weren't, when there wasn't, and therefore there was great tragedy that ensued. One is the case of the Givonim. Another case of the Givonim wasn't such a tragedy, but there was another very famous case where this becomes a significant theme of the story, is essentially the story of Yiftach. And Yiftach's oath vis-a-vis his daughter, vis-a-vis whoever would come out of his house, or whatever would come out of his house, famous. And the tragedy of Yiftach's daughter, to which the Gemara addresses that story in the context of this question. It was clearly a neder al dat rabim. The neder was taken in the heat of battle. It was taken very publicly. It was made publicly for public reasons. Was there a mechanism for annulling even such an oath? Did Yiftach have an out? We're not studying the story of Yiftach now. We will, Bezrat Hashem, when we get to Shoftim. Nonetheless, this is the concept operating in all of these cases. Another famous case is the story of Pilegish Begiva, where there were also oaths taken at various levels, at various stages in the story, and this becomes a relevant piece. So here,
apply to public leadership today.
If you would take an oath, again, the whole institution of Nedarim doesn't apply anymore because we don't use Nedarim in that way. We don't. Nobody stands up and says, "I take a neder b'shem Hashem and declares God's name and makes such." Right? It doesn't have, personal commitments are not in this category of nedarim as we halachically. Some people want to apply them, but they're applied philosophically, not necessarily halachically. If you want to put it in those terms, it's like talking about a value rather than a halachic structure.
Well, philosophically.
Any public oath in this context cannot be annulled. Amar Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi, my time at Rabbi Yehuda. That's the declaration of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi asks the question, why is this the case? And he brings proof from our story. Dechtiv v'lo hikum b'nei Yisrael ki nishbu'u lehem nisyei ha'ida b'Hashem Elokei Yisrael. The proof is exactly our story, namely, that the reason why the Bnei Yisrael did not destroy the Givonim was because they had taken an oath. But they could have annulled the oath, they could have gone to the Beit Din and gone through the process of Hatarat Nedarim, unless, of course, there was something standing in their way. And in this case, the assumption of what was standing in the way is that this was very public. This was very public. That's the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. The opinion of Rabbi Yehuda says that they legally had no option here. They could not have annulled the oath because it was an oath taken in public. Says the Gemara v'Rabbanon, Rabbi Yehuda's one opinion. Rabbi Yehuda means that there's a majority opinion against Rabbi Yehuda who hold that that is not the case. That a neder al dat rabim, even though it's taken in public, does have a mechanism for annulment. May not be the same mechanism as a regular oath. Halachically, the understanding is that a neder al dat rabim can be annulled either by the melech or the kohen gadol. So there is a mechanism in place for that kind of annulment as well, according to the Rabbana. So if that's the case, mi chalach shivua ilavayu klal, according to Rabbanon, why didn't they annul this oath? So he says, "Samichal shvuah layu klal, kivan de amulah me'eretz uchakabano v'lo ba'u lochaylo shvuah ilavayu klal." He says this whole oath is irrelevant. You're assuming that there's an oath, that the oath is taken in public, and that it's a legal structure and a legal framework, and therefore it's a valid oath, and you have to worry about the mechanism for annulment, or for hatarat haneda. He says, "Rabbanan, that whole principle doesn't apply here because the neder was completely on false premises. If it's on false premises, go back to the principle of hafarat neder. I don't need to get the hatarat neder. There's no basis for the oath altogether. So if that's the case, hi delo katlinu. So then why didn't they kill them? If the text tells me that they didn't kill them because of the Shvua, then why does the Rabbanan say that they could have annulled, could have eliminated, they could have ignored this oath altogether? Says the Gemara, Mishum Kiddushat Hashem. Because of the factor of the sanctification of God's name. And if you look at the text, what you find is a very interesting emphasis. It says, V'lo hikum b'nei Yisrael, they didn't destroy them, ki nishbu'u lehem nisyei ha'ida b'Hashem Elokei Yisrael, because they had taken an oath in the name of Hashem, God of Israel. That emphasis is repeated again in Pasuk Yud Tet, V'yemu al kol ha'nisyeim al kol ha'ida, Anachnu nishbanu lehem b'Hashem Elokei Yisrael. So the emphasis here seems to be much more than just the fact that they took an oath, or even that they took an oath in public. But the fact is, they took an oath in the name of God. So that their commitment represents a commitment to God. They've invoked God's name in this story. So their commitment, in a sense, they've said, we represent, we are the people of Israel, we are the people of the chosen people, we are God's people, and in the name of our God, we take this oath. Now, what are they going to do? They're going to go back and say, well, the false oath was taken on false pretense, the oath was taken was basically founded on a lie, and therefore it's null and void. And therefore, an oath uttered in the name of God has now become null and void. So what have they done? They've essentially invoked God's name in vain. That's exactly what the Gemara is saying. Mishum kiddushat Hashem, because of the sanctity of God's name, or the opposite, which is the desecration of God's name, they did not want to go back on their oath. So what the Gemara here is suggesting is there's two possibilities of understanding why B'nai Israel did not go back on their oath. One is legalistic. Structure of Hatarat Neder and Nedel Dat Rabim, and it's a public oath, etc. The other, says Rabbanan, it's not legalistic at all. It's not a legal framework. The Neder is null and void. It's not binding. But there is a philosophical issue. There is a very significant historical and philosophical issue, namely that of Chilul Hashem. In the Rishonim, the application of this Gemara into the discussion of our text leads us to a very interesting place. So there's a machlok of the Rambam and the Radak. Which of these two opinions fits into the pshat of the text? Which of these two approaches? Rabbi Yehuda says that it's a function of Nedol Dat Rabim, and the Chachamim who say that it's an issue of Kiddush Hashem versus Chilul Hashem. Which of these two positions is actually more closely connected to the pshat of the story itself? So here's a fascinating machloket. The Rambam quotes our Gemara virtually verbatim. The Rambam, this is the same Rambam we saw once before, but the Rambam is talking about the letters that they sent into Eretz Yisrael to offer peace to each of the nations of Canaan. So we talked about that before, the option of offering peace to the Amei Canaan. Shlosha ketavim shalach Yeshua ad shelo nechnas la'aretz. To which the Rambam raises the question, if they sent three letters to each of the nations in Canaan, they offered them peace in Cain, mipnei ma he'erimu yoshvei Givon, why do the inhabitants of Givon have to create this ruse to trick Bnei Yisrael? Lefi she'shalach lehem bichlal v'lo kiblu v'lo yadu mishpat Yisrael, because initially they were sent this letter and they refused it, and they didn't know the law of Israel. They thought once they refused and the war started, they didn't have the option of turning around and re-accepting the terms of peace. They thought once the war started, that was it. They had no choice. And there are Rishonim who hold that way. The Rambam does not. And therefore, they felt that they could not. They didn't have an option of making peace. But if that's the case, that they really could have made peace altogether, they really, legally, they could have just come to them and made a peace treaty with them. So if that's the case, lama kasha davar l'nesiyim v'ra'u sh'ra'ui l'hakotam l'fi chereb l'ulei ha'shua mimnei shekartu lehem brit. So if that's the case, what was so difficult to the Nesiyim? They were legally allowed to make a brit with the Givonim. Why do they have to say that the only reason why this brit is valid is because they took an oath? But had they not taken an oath, they should have destroyed them, they should have killed them. What do you mean you should have killed them? They wanted to make a brit, it's allowed. Says the Rambam, הרי הוא אומר לו, אלא היה דינם שיהיו להם למס עבדים, והואיל ובטעות נשבעו להם, really they could have made a brit with them. They could have turned them into mas avadim. But because b'ta'ut nishba'u lehem, because their oath to them was in error, b'din haya shiyahargu al shehit'um. The fact that they tried to trick B'nai Israel was an act of treason. And that was an act for which they could have been guilty, and Israel would have had every right to attack them. Lulei chilul Hashem. Were it not for the Chilul Hashem factor. So the Rambam takes the conclusion of the Gemara verbatim. This whole story is about Chilul Hashem. It's about the desecration of God's name that comes when the people of Israel go back on their word. The Radak has a different take on it.
What does that mean, go back on their word?
In other words, they made a public oath with them. Even though it was based on false pretense, it was very public. Everybody knew about this treaty. We'll see in a moment in Perek Yud Aleph that the nations of the kings of the south all know about this treaty, and they all come to attack the Givonim because of it. So everybody knows that B'nai Yisrael made a treaty. Now, what would happen if they annulled that treaty? What would be the perception? That B'nai Yisrael takes an oath with God's name, and then they annul it. It's irrelevant. I'll clarify it more in a moment, but for now, let's leave it at that. Says the Radak, "V'haya bedin lohargam." First, he quotes the Gemara: "V'haya bedin lohargam im lo haya bedavar chilul Hashem ipnei hashvua." They really should have executed them if it weren't for the oath and because of the question of Chilul Hashem. That's the position of the Rambam, that's the position of the Gemara. Even though the oath was in error, im lo yekaimuha haya b'davar Chilul Hashem. If they were not to fulfill this oath, there would have been a great desecration of God's name. Why? Ki rabim yishma'u b'shvua. Because many people heard about the oath. It was very public. V'lo yishmu b'ta'ut. How many people would hear afterwards that the oath was built and founded on false pretense? The ruse, the fact that they disguised themselves in types of clothing and bought types of food, how many people would have known the facts? They would have looked at it from the outside and seen what? They would have seen a treaty made between B'nai Israel and the Givonim. And 3 days later, B'nai Israel went and executed the Givonim. That's what they would have seen. They wouldn't have seen the background, the nitty-gritty. They wouldn't have delved into the case. They wouldn't have given them the benefit of the doubt. They wouldn't have engaged in an inquiry as to exactly why B'nai Israel executed them. They would have seen simply the facts. B'nai Israel signed a peace treaty with the Givonim. 3 days later, they execute them. Put two and two together. Not only that, when they made this treaty, the treaty doesn't state in public that there was a condition to this treaty. It's a separate issue. He says that they really, the Torah's requirement of the Torah's parameters for a brit with the seven nations was v'ilachal amas v'avaducha. Mas v'avaducha means they pay taxes to you and they do the service of the king. Service of the king is like everybody else in the kingdom who pays mas eved, who pays by a certain period of time that they serve the kingdom. It's a tax. It's a tax and a declaration of citizenship and loyalty. What they did with the Givonim was much more significant. What they did with the Givonim was they made them servants. So the Radak says the reason why they were harsher with the Givonim than they were with any other potential nation of Canaan that would have made peace with them is because they tried to trick them. In other words, there was some punishment to the Givonim for the ruse that they had perpetrated. That's number one. Number two, V'yeshmen abatenu shemru kineder o shvua shenaseh barabim en lo heter. Another possibility is that there's a halachic principle operating here, namely that a public neder has no validity. Vilamdu ze hadavar midvar hagivonim. And they learned this from the source of the story of the Givonim. Shiloi kumba voshinishbale. Vahachokim alehem, the other first opinion that we talked about before, they differ. Ki bedvar hagivonim lochalash valehem klal sherehimut im hayu. The first opinion that says that it's a chilul Hashem factor says that there's no neder here to engage in a discussion about neder al dat ravim, because the neder was on false pretense altogether. Those are the two opinions of the Gemara. He's worked them through the text. Says the Radak in the bold, v'hapsukim mochichim ki divrei mi she'amai ki mifnei she'naset ha'shvuah barabim ein lo heta. He says the pshat of the perek is in line with the ones who say that this was a public oath, and because it was public, that's why they couldn't annul it. The halachic structure of neder al dat rabim. He's a bias to the opinion, not like the Rambam. The Rambam was biased to the opinion that this whole story is founded on the principle of chilul Hashem. The Radak seems to be biased to the opinion that says, no, this story is a function of neder al dat rabim. Why? Because it says, because the text says, Sharei amu hanisiyim v'lo ye alenu ketzef al hashvua v'imlo haya b'davar el rivnei kiddush Hashem ma ketzef haya b'zeh. The nisiyim are afraid that God will be angry at them. If the issue is simply one of chilul Hashem, so why would God get angry at them? God would get angry at them if they violated the shvua. Why should God get angry at them if they perpetrated a giant international chilul Hashem? We've had this before, you know, where the Radak seems to bias the pshat to one position in Chazal, and you have to stand back and say, you know, when I read the Psukim and we read it initially, we seem to think intuitively that the factor here, the emphasis here, at least in the text itself, was the Chilul Hashem factor because of the emphasis on the expression Nishbanu b'Hashem Elokei Yisrael. The Radak seems to have taken a somewhat different approach. There's a third possibility, and the third possibility is that they're both right. That they're both right, correct. Why? Because what is it about neder al dat rabim that makes it unannullable? What is it about the public nature of a neder that makes it so that you can't annul such an oath? Is it simply the fact that you need the neder was made with the public support, and therefore you need the public to annul it? That's one way of looking at it, and that's the simplest halachic way to look at it. That if you take an oath in public, you've invoked the public in that oath. In order to annul it, you therefore need the public, but you can't. You can't gather all the people who were there at the time that you made the neder to come back again and annul the oath. Therefore, the Gemara says the only mechanism is to go to those institutions that represent the tzibor, the melech, the kohen gadol, relevant to the story of Yiftach. But there's another possibility. The reason why you can't annul an oath made in public is because an oath made in public invokes God's name on the tzibor. That Hashem, the pasuk says that Hashem alkecha tirav otot tavod uvishmoti shavea. You take an oath with God's name. And take a look at the Sefer HaMitzvot in source number 5, how he defines what a public oath is about. He says, HaMitzvah HaShviti SheTzivenu LiShavah BiShmo YitAlek KishNitzTarech LaKayem Davar Min HaDvarim LaKhisho Ki BeZeh HaGdula LeShem YitAlek VeKavod VeIlui. Why do we invoke God's name? Because invoking God's name in a neder elevates the entire status of God's name in the world. It invokes God's name in our actions. It says that what we are doing is in the name of God. It's not just me here. I'm doing this because of my religious beliefs. I'm doing this because of my relationship with God. I'm invoking God in the story of my life. Well, the moment I do that, and then I turn around, and I do so in public, so that I've now invoked God's name in public, the moment I turn around and say, I'm going to annul this oath, I've essentially taken away whatever process of invoking God's name in the story of my life was all about. So the very foundation of the rationale from taking an oath in God's name, in public, was to invoke Shem Hashem into the equation, to annul it, is that that's the classic definition of Chilul Hashem. It's to remove God's name from the world, to desecrate God's name in the world, to belittle it, to dismiss it. So in a certain sense, the foundation of Neder al Da'at Rabbim is a Chilul Hashem factor. I'll go one step further. You think about oaths not on the personal level, but on the national level, we're talking about a whole different equation. The optical illusion in this Gemara is the assumption that we're talking about that the mechanism by which you and I would take an oath is the same as the mechanism by which public oaths are taken. But that in and of itself is not true. A public oath is essentially a national one. You can take an oath in public amongst, you know, gather 15 people and you have an Neder al Da'at Rabbim. But that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is an oath taken by the representative body of the nation of Israel. And as such, it represents the totality of the Jewish people. We're talking about a legal treaty between nations. So everything we do impacts, every decision taken impacts the totality of the Jewish people, upon whose head rests God's presence in this world. So, you know, I think that's a very critical part of the story. What we are essentially addressing is the status of the national identity of Bnei Yisrael, or the impact that the behavior of the people, the nation of Israel, has in the world. That's very different from the personal parameters of Neder, Hatarat Nederim, and Afarat Nederim, whether Al Da'at Rabbim or not Al Da'at Rabbim. You know, if the government of Israel signs a treaty and then abandons it, the impact is very different than if you or I make a business deal and then decide to renege on the deal. It's not nice. But it's very different than if you sign a treaty with the state of Israel. This treaty, for all intents and purposes, was signed with the equivalent of the Knesset. It was signed with the Nesiim. So the Rabbim here is the nation of Israel. The Rabbim here is the nations of the world. And they're standing and they're looking and they're watching. I think that these two issues are really interconnected. The Rabbim factor here creates the Chilul Hashem, Kiddush Hashem component in everything they do. If you wanted to take this even further, you could extrapolate it beyond the parameters of Sefer Yehoshua. What's the mandate of the very purpose of Bnei Yisrael in the world? To a certain extent, the very purpose, the raison d'etre for Bnei Yisrael, and for the Torah, and for giving Bnei Yisrael the land of Israel, and for placing us there, and to giving us a national status, the whole context of Bnei Yisrael is to create a Kiddush Hashem in the world. Is to, you know, the Yeshayahu's vision, the concept of an Or LaGoyim, or Zechariah's vision of how nations will come to you and say, we'll grab hold of you, and we'll go with you, Ki Hashem Imachem, because God is with you, or Yeshayahu's vision of the nations coming to the Beit HaMikdash. There's a component of Kiddush Hashem versus Chilul Hashem in everything we do, in the very purpose of our existence. So as a nation, we have to be extraordinarily careful. For every decision that we make and every action that we take. And that, I think, also plays a factor in this story. All right. Questions on that?
It seems that they were held to a higher moral standard. It's the same as today.
Yeah, I think the Nevi'im certainly held them to a higher moral standard. I think they was correct. And in hindsight, I think it was correct that they, you know, their decision not to fight the Givonim, I think, was morally the only decision they could have taken. Consequences of violating the Neder with the Givonim would have been very severe. as it was, the nations of Canaan were not particularly going to sit around and wait for us to come marching into the doorsteps. They were going to take action. But the long-term impact of the story of the Givonim, remember that they're around for a while, the long-term impact of the story of the Givonim and how we treat them and how we relate to them is very significant. Which brings us to the last issue that we have for our discussion, and that is the what happens to the Givonim in history? Where do they go? They just hang around? What is their status? So there's a local part of that equation and there's a global part of the equation. The local part of that equation is that is the next perek. Our next perek of study, which is Perek Aleph, is going to address the question of what was the reaction of the other nations of Canaan to the brit we made with the Givonim. It goes there, it goes beyond. But there's a much more global issue. Assuming the Givonim survive, and they do, and they go on for generations, and they will continue to be what they call the Chotvei Eitz Mishor Vimayim, support staff of the temple and the Mizbeach. And remember that the Nesi'im made them the Chotvei Eitz Mishor Vimayim of the entire people. Yehoshua changed the terms of that agreement, and he made them Chotvei Eitz Mishor Vimayim LaMizbeach. He engaged them specifically in the context of the service of the temple. And part of that was to avoid another Chilal Hashem, which was for all of Bnei Yisrael to sit around and have these slaves and servants working for them who happened to be Givonim. That's the one thing the Torah never wanted, which was to transform the Canaanites into servants and slaves for every Canaanite, that every Israelite should have a shifcho or an eved from the nations of Canaan. That was an untenable situation. So Yehoshua transforms or changes the terms of the agreement. Chotvei Eitzim v'Shua V'Mayim, yes, but la mizbeach Hashem ad yom hazeh, specifically to the context of the mizbeach. What happens to them? Anybody know the next part of their history? Next part of the history is a terrible tragedy. We're going to take you through a time warp all the way to the end of Sefer Shmuel. How many of you are studying Sefer Shmuel with Merav on Wednesdays? Where are you up to? People today. Are you in Shmuel Bet? Mm-hmm. Where?
I think David was moving the
Aron.
The Aron to Yerushalayim.
So that's the beginning. Perek Hey, Perek Vav.
Yeah, still fairly close to the beginning.
Okay. So we are going to take you through a time warp to Perek Chaf Aleph. Shmuel Bet, Perek Chaf Aleph. This time warp takes you ahead of many stories that are yet to come in your study of Sefer Shmuel, namely the whole relationship, the story with David and Bathsheba, the rebellion in David's household, a whole bunch of episodes that happen. Obviously, he doesn't end up building the Beit HaMikdash. Shmuel Bet, and then, of course, is the battle with Shaul, and Shaul's final battle, in which he dies, and we'll come back to the significance of that story. And you learned the... I think it's Shmuel Aleph, Shaul's chase of David into the city of Nov, and his destruction of Nov. Okay.
Shaul
dies in Shmuel Aleph, right? But the aftermath of that battle is going to become relevant to our story. Perek Chaf Aleph. Vayhi Re'av bimei David shalosh shanim shana acharei shana. There was a famine in the days of David for 3 years. Chronologically, these prakim are out of sequence. I'm not going to get into the details of the chronological context here, but we're certainly post-Shaul. There's a famine for 3 years. Vayivakesh David et bnei Hashem. David sought God's face, meaning he prayed to God. He couldn't understand what the cause of this famine was. Vayomer Hashem el Shaul. Vayomer Hashem el Shaul ve'el Beit Hadamim. The reason for this famine is because of Shaul and because of the house of blood. You have to be careful how you read it. It's not Vayomer Hashem el Shaul, because that would be problematic. It's Vayomer Hashem el Shaul ve'el Beit Adamim, meaning the answer to your question is that the reason for this famine is because of two reasons, Shaul and Beit Adamim. What's Beit Adamim? Al asher hemit et ha-givonim. Because Shaul had executed the Givonim. Did you study the story of Shaul and the Givonim at all? Did you touch upon it, mention it? The only explicit reference to it is here. There's a big question that the Mefarshim struggle with, the Gemara struggles with, of where this story took place, because there's no reference to the story anywhere other than here. That there is a retribution taking place because at some point in the past, Saul had slaughtered the Givonim. There's a second retribution taking place because of Saul. In other words, there's two issues here. There's Saul and El Shaul ve'El Beit Adamim. And are they the same or are they separate? We'll see that in the Gemara. Vayikra ha-melech la-givonim ve'yomer aleihem. So David calls over the Givonim. He says to them, ve'ha-givonim. Now, parenthetically, we haven't seen or heard of the Givonim since Yehoshua Perek Tet. So in case you're wondering what happened and who they were and where did they come from and what the story is, so there's a parenthetical insert here that links the two stories. V'ha-givonim lo mivnei Yisrael hema. They're not indigenous Israelites. Ki'im miyeter ha-emori. They're left over from the days of the Amorites and the Canaanite nations. Uvnei Yisrael nishbu'u lahem. And Israel had taken an oath to allow them to live. Va'yivakesh Shaul lahakotam bekan'oto livnei Yisrael v'yuda. Saul had sought to destroy them in his zealousness for Israel and for Judah. At what point in time did Saul, zealous for Israel and Judah, try to execute them? Unclear. Right, the story itself doesn't appear in Tanakh. Vayomer David el ha-givonim, ma eseh lechem uvema achaper. What can I do for you? How can I bring you atonement? What can I do to appease you for this terrible calamity that obviously he's talking to the remnants of what's left of the Givonim. Uvarchu et nachalat Hashem. So that God's inheritance, meaning the land of Israel, can be so blessed. Why does he need blessing for nachalat Hashem? Because they're in a famine. That's exactly right. Vayamulu agivonim. The Givonim said to him, Ein li kesef v'zahav im Shaul v'im beto. We have no desire for gold and silver. We don't have a monetary claim against Saul. There's no money in the world that you could pay us to compensate for our hurt. Ve'en lanu ish lahamit b'Yisrael. Nor do we have any desire to kill anybody in Israel. Ve'yom ma atem omrim es elechem. So David said, whatever you want, tell me and I'll do. Ve'yomu al ha-melech, ha-ish asher kilanu, ve'asher dima lanu. Nishmadnu mitetzev b'chol gvu Yisrael. The man who destroyed us, who has destroyed our presence from being a significant force in the nation of Israel, is Shaul. Yutan lanu shiva anashim mibanav, v'ka'anu l'Hashem b'givat Shaul b'chir Hashem. Give us 7 of his children to execute. Pause. Big pause. In the middle of the pasuk, pause. Just think about for a minute where David is at now. His hands are tied. There's a famine in the land. He knows that there's a famine because of the execution of the Givonim. He knows that he has to do something to appease them. And they turn to him and they give him terms that are really reprehensible. Vayomer HaMelech, and David says, so be it. Ve'achmol ha-melech ha-mefiboshet ben Yonatan ben Shaul. Of course, to do this, he has to violate his oath to Yohanan ben Shaul, because one of the children is Mephibosheth ben Yohanan. Al shivat Hashem Hashem Yonatan ben David ben Yonatan ben Shaul, v'ikach ha-melech et shnei b'nei ritzpa bat ayah she'yalda le-Shaul et armoni ve'et Mephibosheth. He takes two of the children of the Pilagshim, ritzpa bat ayah, and Armoni and Mephibosheth, but Chameshet b'nei Michal bat Shaul, she'yalda le-Adriel ve'Barzillai mecholati, and five of the sons of Michal, v'yitnem his ex-wife. ויתנם ביד הגבעונים ויוקיעום בהר לפני השם ויפלו שבעתם יחד. At this point in the story, I don't think Michal is still around. Could be mistaken. Maybe. והם הומתו בימי קציר בראשונים בתחילת קציר סורי. Patikach, Ritzpa bat ayah et hasak. Ritzpa bat ayah is the mother of two of these children. She's the pilagish. She took sackcloth. Vatateo leel atzur mitchilat katsir ad nitach mayim alehem min hashamayim. And she covered them. She protected them by the rock until the beginning of the, until the rains came. Velo netana of hashamayim lanuach alehem yomam ve'atchayat asedah laila. She protected the carcasses so that nothing should ever happen to them. She sat there in mourning next to the children and protected the carcasses from the vultures. Vayigad David et asher asta ritzpa bat ayah pilagash Shaul. David was so moved by the devotion of this pilagash, of this ritzpa bat ayah pilagash Shaul. Vayelech David vayikach et atzmot Shaul et atzmot Yonatan beno me'et balei yavesh Gilad. So he went and he decided to pay the same kind of respect. He was so moved, he was somewhat embarrassed by the devotion and dedication and respect that Ritzpa bat ayah had paid to the sons of Shaul, that he realized that he was missing a piece. And the piece that he was missing was the proper burial of Shaul himself. Because Shaul died in battle with Yavesh Gilad. Died in battle in Yavesh Gilad, and his body was taken and was stolen, essentially desecrated. Asher ganvu otam mirachov Beit Shan, asher talum sham. They were hung there after they were killed. Asher shum sham haplishtim, the plishtim had hung them there. V'yom akot plishtim et she'u b'gilboa. Sorry, let me rephrase the facts. The battle with the Plishtim was in Gilboa. The people of Yavesh Gilad, after Shaul had been killed in battle, the Plishtim went and hung his body up for all to see. The people of Yavesh Gilad went and took the body out of the hands of the Plishtim and brought it back to Yavesh Gilad. So David went after he saw what Ritzpa bat ayah had done, and he went and he took the body of Shaul and Yonatan out from the hands of Yavesh Gilad. And he gave them a proper burial in the territorial burial plot of the house of Kish. And then God released the land from its famine. Really remarkable story. It's remarkable on multiple levels. It's remarkable for David, which if we're studying Sefer Shmuel, we would analyze the story from the perspective of David and what he was doing and why. And one of the big questions is why he agrees to the terms of the Givonim.
Didn't David, when we're learning in Shmuel, but didn't David at the beginning, he ran to the Plishtim?
The relationship with David and the Plishtim is a separate story, but Shaul dies in battle against the Plishtim, that we know, in Gilboa, and the story of Shaul's burial is here. Shaul is taken by Yavesh Gilad, protected, you know, the Plishtim tried to desecrate the body, Yavesh Gilad went and protected the body, and then David went, and he finally gives him a state burial.
So how much time period was there between?
Well, that's, the chronology is unclear. The chronology is unclear. I'm going to leave the chronology out of the picture for a moment. If I take it at face value, it's many, many years later. I'm not sure the chronology here. It's complicated because the last prakim of Shmuel Bet are out of chronological sequence.
Why would they give it back to body?
Yevesh Gilad? Why wouldn't they? Yevesh Gilad are on Shesh Lomenu, as they say. They're Israelites.
They took it to protect it.
They took it to avoid it being desecrated by... Yevesh Gilad has a long, loyal history with Shaul. But it goes all the way back to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, when Shaul fought his very first campaign to protect the people of Yevesh Gilad. So Yevesh Gilad have a very long, loyal history to Shaul.
But why would they go against his oath to
Yehuda? Yavid's behavior here is quite remarkable, although it's not clear that the Mephibosheth here may be a different Mephibosheth. In other words, he's Yevayachmolo Mephibosheth ben Yonatan. He takes Mephibosheth ben Ritzpah bat Ayah. Not clear that it's the same Mephibosheth. Probably not the same Mephibosheth. Be that as it may, the issue in this parak really revolves around, and the issue that the Gemara addresses is, it revolves around the question of Shaul more than David. David's behavior is a separate parsha. And time permitting, I'll come back to the issue of David. But Shaul's behavior here is remarkable. Where and when did Shaul try to execute the Givonim?
Shows you that they existed as a population
right.
That whole time.
That's right. And that's the key piece. That's the key piece. That the Givonim, the aftermath of this breach with the Givonim is that the Givonim are around for a very long time. They survive the massacre of Shaul. They survive in the time of David, who protects them. They're given special status. In the time of Chazal, they go even one step further, and they have a specific... Chazal give them a different name, but they also have a special status, and it's unclear whether their status are proper gerim. Well, it's their legal status within the framework of Bnei Yisrael is in question. So Gemara often puts them into the category of mamzerim. Mamzerim is a group of Israelites who can't marry other Israelites, can only marry within themselves because of their own yuchus issues. So the Gemara often puts the Givonim, or their descendants, who are called Netinim, into that same category of people for whose yichus or status is in question. So they can marry within themselves, but they don't marry or intermarry within the rest of Bnei Israel. So take a look at the flip side of the source page that I've given you. It's a lengthy piece of the Gemara in Yevamos. We're not going to go through it all. Not to worry. I'm going to show you a couple of interesting pieces of it.
Isn't that hard to do?
What?
Stay like just within this little body?
Well, the Shomronim do it today. Right? The Shomronim in northern Israel who live in the area of Shechem, they do it. And for a long time they were much larger. In the days of Shaul they were much smaller. Says the Gemara, the Gemara starts with the Mishnah, Mamzerim u'netinim. This is the Mishnah that says that we are not allowed to marry into Mamzerim. Mamzerim can only marry themselves. They can't marry into the rest of Bnei Israel. That's a Torah prohibition. And the Mishnah includes in that context the Netinim. Who are the Netinim? The Netinim are our story. Amar of Chada bar Ado. Who are the Netinim? David Gazar Alehem. The Netinim, it was David who decreed. In this context, it says the Gemara, at least initially, this notion that the Gibbonim are not from Bnei Yisrael. If they're not from Bnei Yisrael, it means he can't marry them. My time gazar alayu, dechti vahiva abi me David shalosh shanim shana achrei shana vayvekesh David epnei Hashem vayomer Hashem oshaul ve'al beit damim asher amit et haGibbonim. Gemara starts with our pasuk, and here the Gemara breaks down that key phrase, El Shaul. What does it mean, El Shaul Vel Beit HaDamim? This famine is because of twofold. Number one, because of Shaul, and number two, because of Beit HaDamim. El Shaul, says the Gemara, Shalon Ispad Kalacha. The first issue is that God was punishing Bnei Israel for the lack of respect that they had shown to Shaul, that he was never given a proper state burial and therefore a state eulogy. He was, after all, Melech Yisrael Mashiach Hashem. And secondly, this famine was because punishment for what Shaul had done to execute, to massacre the Givonim. Now that in and of itself is fascinating, because the two contradictory reasons. Mm-hmm. Right. On the one hand, you are defending the image of Shaul, and on the other hand, you are punishing Bnei Yisrael for what Shaul did. And that the Gemara addresses in the next paragraph, where Gemara says, this is self-contradictory, and the Gemara answers, yes, that's exactly right. They're contradictory, and yet, they're both correct. And here's the critical question. Where did Shaul ever execute the Givonim? Where did the story come from? So there are several possibilities. The Gemara offers one. The Gemara's offer, the suggestion is, Mitoch Shaharag Nov, Ir HaKohanim, Shayum Maspikim Lehemayin Umazon, Ma'aleh Alav HaKatuv Ki'ilu Hagan. The suggestion here is that, remember, the Chotvei Etzim V'Shuav Himayim are the servants of the Mizbeach, the servants of the temple. By the time, in the days of Shaul, where was the Mizbeach? The Mizbeach was in the city of Nov. After the fall of Shiloh, when the Aron got taken by the captive by the Plishtim, so the Aron and the Mizbeach split apart. The Aron goes from, am I telling you something you've heard, not heard? You're familiar with it, right? This is the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. Right, the Aron goes from...
Remember.
You can't remember. You don't need to remember it. We'll come back to it. We'll study it in detail when we get to Sefer Shmuel. We're going to go through... We're going through this systematically. But the Aron comes back from Eretz Plishtim and gets taken to the city of... Where does it get put? No, after the Shiloh is destroyed, Shmuel Aleph, Perek Hey, Shiloh falls, the Aron comes back from the Plishtim, and they take it to? No, the Mizbeach goes to Nov. The Aron goes to? Kiryat Yearim. Interesting place. Right? Tell us, right? Kiryat Yearim. And there it shall remain. And the Aron goes to? Nov. So the functionality, so the people in Kiryat Yearim are protecting the Aron, and the Mizbeach is sitting in Nov. What happens in Nov? Shaul comes to Nov at some point or another. So who's, right? Nov is the source of the Parnasa for the Givonim. They're working in the Mizbeach. They are the Chotvei Etzim Yishuav Himayim in the Mizbeach. If Shaul kills the Kohanim in Nov, so essentially he's removed the Parnasa from the Givonim. So that's one possibility, that he didn't actually execute the Givonim, but that rather he simply removed their parnasa, and part of this is really retribution for the execution of, and for the massacre of Nov.
Oh.
The massacre, the aftermath of the massacre of Nov, was realized the impact was not just for Nov. The impact was far more than just that. You take away, it's like closing down the plant. Once you close down the plant, the impact is you send all of the workers in the plant, you're now unemployed. So all of the Givonim are now unemployed. Right. The result of which is...
There was no punishment ever for the Kohanim that
one? I'm sure. That's an internal study of Sefer Shmuel. There was, but that's part of the whole. The other possibility is that he really did go and execute the Givonim, maybe as part of his military campaign, maybe because he felt it was time to undo the wrong that had been done in the days of Sefer Yehoshua. It could also be, remember, at one point Shaul goes to the land of Israel and he executes all the soothsayers and magicians and the Ov and Yidonim, etc. Well, who are the Givonim? They're outsiders. So he could have very well have gone through it at that time. There's all kinds of different theories as to when and how he would have
made the assumption that it was wrong in your statement, that it was wrong what they did.
Because that's what the Torah says, that's what the Navi says. The Navi says that the reason why they were being punished with famine for 3 years was because of the execution of the Givonim by the hands of Shaul. Beit Hadamim asher himitu the Givonim. Let me just conclude with one sentence, and that is this whole story of the Givonim in Sefer Shmuel, it's all about, and here's the irony that comes back to the beginning of our discussion, it's all about the loyalty to an oath at various levels. Mm-hmm. It's about the Givonim and the loyalty Bnei Yisrael had to their oath to the Givonim. Mm-hmm. It's about Shaul, who violates that contract violates that loyalty and who either actively executes them or passively executes them. It's about David and his commitment to his oath to Shaul and to Yehonatan, partially to Yehonatan in the story of Mephibosheth, partially to Shaul because of the hesped that he gives him at the end of Shaul. It's about the loyalty of a little known woman, Pilagish of Shaul, by the name of Ritzpah Bat Ayah, who spends months sitting in a cave protecting the carcasses of her children because of a loyalty that she had to her family and to her, and the chesed that she felt was obligatory. And at the end, it's the story of the chesed of David to the descendants of Shaul and to Shaul himself. So the story essentially takes all of the themes that revolve around the life and times of the Givonim and their story, and you see them migrating, you see them sort of coming and going in different ways in the context of the story of the Givonim in the days of Shaul. That's, for now, all we're going to have time to deal with. Bezrat Hashem, next week we start Perek Yud Aleph. Sorry, Perek Yud. Perek Yud. I was going to skip Yud and go straight to Yud Aleph, but you caught me. All right, next week we start Perek Yud.